I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to episode number 157 of the Functional Nerds. John, we are actually approaching episode 200 on SF Signal. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I wasn't, but you guys do two shows a week, so that makes sense. You know, we can all feel good about our podcasting until you hang out with Brian Ibbett of Coverville for a weekend and realize that he is coming up on episode 1000. So. Well, he's done like three shows a week since the dawn of podcasting. So that's how you do that.
I wonder if you added up all of Mer Lafferty's various shows and podcasts and episodes, if you'd be hitting close to that as well.
Oh, quite possibly. Yeah, it is good. But that is Patrick Hester. He is an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I'm a songwriter and a composer, and you can check out my music for free over at johnanilio.com. You can follow me at John Anilio. And this week we're joined once again by Chris F. Ohm. His collector books recast the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned pulp novels. The third book in the series, The Big Reap, was released by Angry Robot Books on July 30th. Chris, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, very good. So, you know, last time we were talking about our horror movies stuff. So I wonder what we're going to get into this week. Are we going to talk about the straight up slasher films this time? Or
I do have a question for Chris.
Yeah,
That is a really sad bookshelf in the back. you know that you can have more than one bookshelf. You don't have to put all the books on one shelf.
You know what's funny about that is what you can't see is just off camera, there's another bookshelf that looks exactly like it. And further off camera, there's a third. That's just in the office. We have, I'm guessing, 10 or 12 more bookshelves in the house that all look more or less exactly like that. Yeah. And those are just the books that my wife and I can't bear to part with.
I'm teasing you, but to be honest, I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4... 5, 6, I think, bookshelves that look exactly like yours. You know, it's like you put the first row on and then you start Tetrising and just, you know, putting as many books on there as you possibly can. And people come in and are like, oh, you got a lot of books, but I can't tell what any of them are.
Yeah, and we do this so that we don't have to box them up. But once they're three layers deep, it really doesn't matter. Obviously, the listeners at home can't see this, but if you actually look at the base of that bookshelf, you can see it just extends out onto the floor for several books, a good 3 or 4 feet. And I'm not going to lie to you, I actually moved a few stacks so it would look less atrocious before I signed onto this, which is doubly embarrassing. I think one of the best ideas I've ever heard in my life came courtesy of a brilliant TV writer, Jane Espenson, who said that she was sick of moving all the books in her house whenever she had people come over. So she wanted to create like a book cozy where you would just slide this little upholstered square over your books and it would just look like an ottoman when people came over, because if they're there long enough, they're furniture.
I actually have, you can't see it, but in the super secret underground lair of the Functional Nerds, I do have a wall on that side of the room that is completely blank. And my dream is to turn that into a built-in bookcase. From what I understand, in order to do that, you have to use things like saws, wood, nails, hammers, paint, possibly screwdrivers, all the stuff that I don't understand why none of it is Bluetooth compatible. And Apple, I went to the Apple store and they looked at me crazy when I was asking them about it. Apparently it's not anything that you can buy at the Apple store. So yeah. I'm not sure where you're supposed to get that kind of shit, but I guess, you know, you go online, you can't find it there either. So I don't know where that stuff comes from. But that would be the dream to have over on that wall.
That's yeah. You know, Patrick, as a my dad's an electrician, and you know, he can build stuff. He's a pretty good carpenter too. And
but where does he get it? Where does he get it? If the Apple Store isn't selling it, I don't understand.
There's a place called Home Depot you can get most of the stuff in. That's a good place to go for it. Yeah, it's you know, he's great at all that stuff, and I don't think I inherited the genes. And the like three times in my childhood when he tried to teach me how to do anything, my dad, sort of being a sort of stereotypical construction worker level of patience with children, you know, when he would show me how to do something and I wouldn't get it right away, he'd be like, "Brr!" And so I was scared off from learning how to do any of that stuff. So I'm completely useless as a man, pretty much. So, but I can quote most of Star Wars.
Yeah, so me too. Yeah. And that
you nailed down the things that mattered. When
yes. Yeah, exactly.
And I like to tell myself that women find that hot.
You could tell yourself that all you want, and it's usually not true.
it's like the line from The Big Bang Theory. You know, did you? This is Wallowitz talking to Penny when Penny set him up on a blind date. Did you tell him that I speak five languages? And Leonard says, "Girls don't count Klingon."
Yeah, typically no. Typically no, unless they are. But anyway, so let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
I will go first with my pick this week, and it is the soundtrack, although I have not seen the movie yet. Hopefully I will very soon. It is the soundtrack to Pacific Rim. The composer is, I'm going to kill his name, I apologize. It's Ramin, I think it's Djawadi. He also does the soundtrack for the Game of Thrones series. So the theme that everybody has, same composer. The Pacific Rim soundtrack is great. It's I would imagine it's good writing music too. Very epic, as you would imagine. The really cool thing about it is there's a lot of guitar on this soundtrack, and that guitar is provided by Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine. So nerds, hold on a minute. It's the Game of Thrones composer with the Rage Against the Machine guitar player. So if that isn't something that interests you, I'm not really sure what would. It is very good. So just the straight up Pacific Rim soundtrack, and Ramin, RamindjAwadi. I think it's Ramin Djawadi, but I'm probably saying it wrong. Excellent. Just exactly what you'd imagine, you know. So Tom Morello's guitar is supposed to be sort of the sound palette for the robots. So there you go. So it's very good.
And John, I have seen Pacific Rim.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you right now, I cannot decide. Pacific Rim is either the greatest fucking movie I have ever seen in my life, or the worst.
That seems to be a common opinion. A lot of people seem to feel that way. Yeah. I have some people that just straight out love it or straight out don't like it, but a lot of people seem to sort of go vacillate between the two extremes.
Yeah. And I will say this, you can take Jax out of the Sons of Anarchy, but apparently you can't take Jax out of the actor who plays him on Sons of Anarchy.
Is that Charlie Huffman? Is that the name of that actor? I know he was in anyway, I remember that actor from that old Judd Apatow show, so I know from there. But your soundtrack's great, so it's definitely worth it's up on Spotify. If you're a Spotify user, I'm sure you can get it on iTunes and all that too. So that is my pick, the Pacific Rim soundtrack. Chris, what is your pick this week?
So I would be shocked if this hadn't come up on the podcast before, but my pick of the week is Orphan Black, which is a tremendous show that aired recently on the BBC America. It's actually a Canadian series, and it's now available on DVD and via various streaming services. It is science fiction done well for television. It's not effects heavy. They do have some significant effects because the main the actress who sort of anchors the show, Tatiana Maslany, actually appears as several characters. And so they do have some effects to tie those performances together. But by and large, it's a very human, character-driven show with some fantastic ideas and just a stunning performance from Tatiana Maslany. I would highly recommend any geeks out there who haven't seen it, seek it out. It's a complete travesty. She wasn't nominated for an Emmy. Just a tremendous show from front to back.
I've heard nothing but good things about the show on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah, me too. I haven't seen it yet, but it's definitely on the must watch once it comes up on Netflix. Cool, very good. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
Before I mention my pick, John, I was curious: are you doing any live performances anytime soon?
As of now, no. I just did Nerdtacular, but that's okay. It for now. I don't have anything else booked at the moment.
I was just curious if at any point you were planning like a live performance where George R.R. Martin was going to come out, take your guitar as you were doing George R.R. Martin is not your bitch, take your guitar from you and smash it.
But why would he? Because it's a pro George R.R. Martin song.
I know, but he just did that to Paul and Storm.
Oh, I know, and that will bring us to our to our main topic this week.
Actually. Well, yeah.
That's why you brought it up.
My pick this week, and I don't remember if I've talked about this before. I found a documentary about George Harrison.
Is this the did Scorsese do it? George Harrison.
I don't think it was Scorsese.
Okay.
And to be honest with you, I don't even remember the name of it right now. I just remember that it's the George Harrison documentary, and basically it looks at his entire life, you know. And I just remember I always do the voice. I go, George Harrison. My name is George Harrison. It looks at it and it has interviews with people. So it looks at his life very early on when Paul got him. A audition with John to be part of the band, all the way through his death, and actually kind of beyond, because they talk about, you know, some things that happened and like his his impact, you know. And he was this really cool guy, and a lot of people focus, when they focus on the Beatles, they focus on John and Paul. Because they were the drivers, they were the original sound or music composers. You know, they wrote all the songs, and it was always, if you talk about formulas, you look at the Beatles albums. There was always, you know, like 9 John and Paul songs and 1 song written by George and 1 song sung by Ringo, and it was like a formula. And as time went on and John and Paul became better and better songwriters, it became harder and harder for George to even get that 1 song on the album.
And he became a better and better songwriter. And I would argue that in the later albums, the George songs, if they're not as good, and I would say in some cases, they're the better songs on the album. If you get to Abbey Road and you get to something, I mean, the George songs on Abbey Road are the best songs on it, in my opinion, and I'm not alone in that opinion there. So that must have been very hard for him.
It was.
Because if you look at George Harrison, you compare him to every other songwriter at the time. If George Harrison wasn't in the Beatles, he would have been one of the biggest singer-songwriters at the time, but unfortunately he was in a band with the two best songwriters of his time, you know.
And so it's a really good look at his life and the things that he did. The people that, you know, there's a lot of talk with Eric Clapton in it, because, you know, he and Clapton became friends very early on. You know, of course, Clapton stole his wife. You know, there's all, but, you know, basically, Clapton even at one point says something along the lines of, you know, George just recognized in Clapton a kindred soul and a kindred talent. And that's why he kind of allowed him into the circle, so to speak. And it's just this really great look at this guy's life, you know, and everything he did. You know, there would not be, there probably wouldn't be Monty Python films if it weren't for
George Harrison. I know. Yeah, he funded one of the first ones. Yeah,
and you know, he also he had his film company, and I forget which one of the, is it Terry Jones or Terry Gilliam, whoever the director is. He did a lot of movies that were pushed out through George Harrison's production company. All the songs that George released on his first solo album were written during the Beatles years and just never made it onto any Beatles albums because there wasn't room for them. You know, so he just kept honing his craft like you were talking about, and eventually got him on his own solo album. So just for me, from a perspective of a Beatles fan, it was just a really good, solid documentary about George Harrison.
Cool. Is it called Living in the Material World?
It might be, yes.
Okay, because that one, it was from 2011, and that is Scorsese as the director. That's what just came up on IMDb. So
it might be that one. Yeah, it was a really long one. It was like...
It's 208 minutes here.
Yeah. I remember, so it was like a hugely long. I had to watch it in like two sittings.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I will check that out because I'm a big Beatles fan. So that sounds great. Very good. All right. Well, let us get on to our main topic this week. And our main topic is something we've talked about before, certainly.
I quit.
Now I wrote this email to to the people that are on my mailing list, and I put it up as a blog post, and of course it was titled "I Quit." And Patrick, the minute the blog post went up, he was like, "What's up with this?" and I think I've explained it pretty well at this point. And I'm going to start sort of personally, but we're going to get into a larger discussion about why we do our creative things. And when we were coming up with topics for the shows that Chris was going to be on, Chris had mentioned this and sort of his own sort of, I don't know if struggles is going to be the right word, but his own thoughts on, you know, how you balance those two versus trying to make a living doing this stuff and doing it for your own sort of artistic edification. So I wrote this blog post called "I Quit," and I'll be clear, I was being a bit dramatic and sensationalist with the title. I wanted to get people's attention. I'm not quitting writing music and recording music, and I'm not even really quitting writing geek music, but what I am quitting is worrying about sort of my place in all of this and worrying about should I be playing these kinds of gigs? And how come this? And Patrick joked around about George R. R. Martin smashing Paul and Storm's guitars. And I got several emails from people. It was more than several. It was quite a lot.
I almost wrote one.
Yeah. And some are from, and I'm not going to mention names, but some are from some friends of the show who are pretty well known, who are like, "What the fuck? Why were you not there? And I will say this, I'm not upset about that at all, because I actually came to this "I quit" thing months and months ago. I just sort of shared it with the world a couple weeks ago. But I will say this, I opened for Paul and Storm a year ago at Nerdtacular, and they were super duper nice to me. They were really nice guys. They really treated me well. They really made me feel like I was part of this whole thing, and they were great. And I will say, I think George R. R. Martin and Neil Gaiman are super busy, super famous guys. And my guess is that whole bit probably came together real last minute. You know, I really don't know if Paul and Storm were able to talk to George R. R. Martin months ago to get him to do that. My guess is someone was like, "Hey, you want to come to this Woodstock thing tonight and smash a guy's guitar?" Like, I'm guessing that's how it came together, and I wasn't there, so it's no big whoop. But it does bring up the point of, if that happened 6 months ago or a year ago, I would have been devastated. I would have been like, this is crap. I should have been there, and why am I not there, and why am I not further along with all of this? And it's funny, in talking to so many authors over the now into the fourth year of doing this show, what I think Patrick and I have discovered is no one's ever happy with where they are. Everybody is always like, feels like they should be further along, feel like they should be selling more books, or feel like they should be included in on conversations about, you know, where they should be and where they shouldn't be, and they should be in this group. And I know from my own experience doing this, I guess I just started to think about, well, what if I was? Like, you know, I have had the opportunity to open for Paul and Storm and to open for Molly Lewis and Marion Call and sort of the people in sort of the geek music world. I've kind of done shows with, other than Jonathan Colton, I've kind of done shows with most of them at this point. And it's great. But I don't even know if there's a living to be made there, to be honest with you. I don't even know if there is for a man that has a family to support, at least anyway. So I just came to this. I don't want to waste any more time worrying about what I'm doing and worrying about, do I have the same level of respect as these people, and shouldn't I be included in these? Because it's like, ultimately, that doesn't matter. And I really started to feel like it was hurting my actual music writing. I felt like I was starting to write songs because I'm like, I'm a nerdy songwriter and nerds will like this song, so I'm going to write this kind of song. And I really feel like that was starting to happen to me. And I don't want to do that. I want to write good songs. And I bet lots of them will be nerdy because I'm into nerdy things. So lots of them will still be nerdy, but I just want to sort of allow myself to just write what I feel like, write what's going to sort of satisfy me artistically and share it with the people that already like what I do. I'm very fortunate in that I do have a lot of people that like what I do. I do have a pretty big, I have about 2,500 people on my mailing list. Those are people that have all downloaded my music that wanted to be on my mailing list. So that's a pretty nice number of people, and I will take it. And when I send out these emails, I always get nice responses from people, and a lot of people are going through the same thing that I'm going through. I got tons of email and tons of comments on this blog post about people that are sort of experiencing the same thing. And I want to focus on them and focus on just doing good stuff. So that's where I'm at with it. So, Chris, what about you? Like, you know, you wanted to talk about this. So what's sort of your experience with this kind of stuff?
Well, actually, not to throw it right back to you, but I'm actually really curious about something you said, where you said this is a decision you came to 6 months ago or months ago. It's been a while in the making. And then you said several months ago with the guitar smashing incident that that you would have been devastated. So I'm curious. It sounds as though you didn't write that post from a point, from a low point at all, but almost from a point of catharsis, where you've really become kind of a little more comfortable with with where you're at. You know, how has the response been reflective of that, or have people taken it as a sign of frustration or a sign of anger?
A couple people. I did have to clarify things a little further via email or comments where they didn't, Patrick's one of them, where they didn't really get the whole gist of the email right away. So I did. I would say the vast majority of people did get my intent of being at a place of, you know, at a good place with it all, and not at a point of frustration. But a lot of people wrote their own blog posts about it and about their own personal experiences. You know, we have a lot of author friends that listen to the show, that, and a lot of them are independent authors, and a lot of them are trying to make their way doing it. And it's the same thing. It's, you know, they get frustrated, and, you know, let's face it, most of us are adults, and most of us have day jobs, and many of us have families and relationships, and we have little time to work on our art as it is. And there is always a balance of trying to get it out there and get an audience for it and all that. And and obviously you always have to balance that stuff. I guess where I came from was a real getting to a real dark place at one point of being, it's almost better to not have any success in some ways, because when you start getting sort of close, you're like really like right there, and you start to get this feeling like I'm this close. I'm like right on the cusp. I'm like right here. Like I did this. And so when do the gates open, you know? And, that was a dark place, because you get to that where you start to feel like I deserve this. And that's a really ugly place to be. And I was there at one point where I started to feel like I deserved to do this. And you realize no one deserves anything. I mean, and I don't mean that in a cynical way, but we don't deserve anything. No one deserves shit. We really don't. We do this because that's what we do. And I think what's more important, and what I find even more valuable, is the interaction that we have with people. And I really do consider myself extraordinarily lucky that over the course of doing this, I've gotten to connect with lots and lots of people through my what I do and through what they do. Because usually when I talk to people, it's about what we're all doing. And that's a good place to be. And I want to sort of focus more on that and not on the, oh, I'm not at Woodstock and I deserve to be at Woodstock or whatever. Because I started realizing, like, well, what would the big deal be? One of the email responses that I wrote back to somebody about this, I was like, all right, so let's say they did ask me to do that. And again, I take no slight that they didn't. I think it really probably did come together last minute. I just wasn't there, and they weren't going to fly me out from New Jersey on a day's notice to do that. But let's say I was, and let's say it all came together and I went and I did the song. Okay, some more people would probably know who I am. That's about it. Maybe I'd sell a couple albums. I'm not going to be able to quit my day job. I don't suddenly go on tour and make $1 million. It's not going to change my life in any significant way if I did do it. So when you start realizing that, you just get comfortable with the fact that, like, oh, well, then I should be doing this because I like doing it, and I shouldn't worry about any of that other stuff. So that's kind of the point that I came to with it.
See, I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this and what resonated with me is in June, I'm coming at this from a perspective of my first book came out the beginning of last year. I've released two books since. And in June, I was really reflecting on where I've been and where I'm going. And I wrote a blog post called What It's Like. Just looking at, you know, a lot of people don't talk about what it's like day to day being at this point in your career. You know, you see a lot of stuff from struggling people. You see a lot of stuff from wildly successful authors. And I just wanted to talk about, like, the fact that it's been a hell of a ride. It's been amazing. But once that initial rush, you know, of that pie-eyed delight at every new experience sort of fades, what you're left with is a lot of stress and a lot of worry and a lot of expectations, both extrinsic and intrinsic. And learning to adjust to that new normal has been a really interesting thing for me. And I'd like to clarify to say I don't consider that a writerly bitch session, because I am the first to admit I am insanely fortunate. I have complete strangers who want to read my work and bug me about when the next one is going to be out. And, you know, that's tremendous. But what's interesting is I've long said that writing, one of the things I love about it is that it's not a zero-sum game. I don't have to lose for someone else to win and vice versa. But it's very easy to get trapped in a mentality where someone gets nominated for something and you're like, oh, how did I miss the cut? Or, you know, you sweat all these tiny details about where you should be, or, man, they got that banner ad on that site, or, you know, the blurb from the famous person who you adore. And what's interesting, too, is it's almost fed by the way internet culture works. For example, you know, my books happen to be on a similar publishing schedule to Chuck Wendig's. Chuck and I are friends on Twitter. I've never met him in person, but we, you know, we share a publisher. And
he prefers Chuck motherfucking Wendig.
Yes, exactly. As well he should. But what's funny is what you see is like, oh, you're reading that book. You should be reading Chris's instead, or you're reading Chris's. You should drop that and read Chuck's. And it's like, guys, you know, we're not actually in competition. Which is good, thank God, because Chuck would kick my ass. He's got his army of fans. But it's a really interesting process that we always internally and externally kind of pit people. It's the Coke or Pepsi, the, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, you find yourself slipping into those roles in your own mind. And it's been it's been really interesting. And also from my standpoint, I would like to make my living full time as a writer at some point. And I've had enough success where I think that goal, while still distant, is attainable. But my concern there is it starts to color your decision making. One of the things I love about the collector books for me is they are a sandbox big enough to encompass any story I might want to tell. However, you know, when I start thinking about if I want to reach a larger audience, do I abandon that and do something more commercial? And if so, isn't that a terrible decision? You know, a terrible way to make that decision. You know, you want to go where the art takes you rather than try and leap from rock to rock chasing trends. And it's been an interesting education, kind of shifting into from aspiring writer to professional writer. It's been an education.
Yeah. Patrick, your thoughts on some of this?
I'm trying to decide what to say.
Okay, then do you want to give you a minute? Or
I don't want to say that I'm cynical, but I have issues with the concept that you espouse, which basically comes down to, well, it's my art, and, you know, I'm going to suffer from my art. I'm going to do my day job. And I've got a little bit of time for my art. Chris is saying, you know, the transition from being an aspiring writer to being a professional writer. However, I am not a professional writer in the sense that it actually pays my bills. There is this idea that if you are an author, if you're an artist, and it's dirty to get paid for that and to have that be that's how you pay your bills. And it shouldn't be about that. It should be about your art. And if it's not about your art, then you are stupid and you're this and you're that. You know, I've talked to plenty of authors who kind of feel that way. It's like, well, it's not about the money. It's about the art. Well, okay. So let me put this into context for you, John. Your principal comes to you at the beginning of the semester and says, okay, so here you go, John. Here's $10,000. And this is your pay for the entire semester. And if your children that you teach, if they pass all the tests and they graduate at the end of the school year and they all get A's, we're going to give you some more money. But if they get B's, we're going to give you this. And if they get C's, we're going to give you this. And if they get D's, we're probably not going to ask you to come back next year and teach another mm-hmm. semester. Or if you are, let's say you're a homeowner and you've decided you're going to take advantage of the home market right now. You're going to sell your house and you bring a realtor out. And the realtor says, well, you need to do some landscaping. You need to do this and that. Okay. And you bring a contractor and you say to the contractor, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you $5,000 now. And if the house sells, I'll give you some more money later.
Mm-hmm.
Right now there are people listening to this who are having a shit fit. And I'm oversimplifying and I'm not getting it right. And I'm this and I'm that, whatever. Here's what I'm trying to say. The model in publishing, the model is, you know, I almost feel like the author part of it is interchangeable. They can put any author, they can plug them in like a plugin in a browser. And it doesn't matter. They have set contracts, they have set schedules and fees, and this is how it's done. And you talk to every writer out there and they're like, yeah, you know, I'm a published author. I've got tons of fans, but I can't afford to pay my bills. So I have to keep my day job, but I'm a professional writer now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me like if you're a professional writer, you shouldn't have a day job. Does that make sense? It's like, if that's what you're doing, that's what you're doing. Kevin J. Anderson has been doing this for 25 years. I would consider him a professional author because he's paying his bills with his writing. You have other folks who transition slowly, you know, they are working at a day job, they're writing, they're getting a little bit of money, they're building, you know, it's like a building thing. But mm-hmm. when you look at the publishing industry as a whole, the janitor who cleans the offices at Tor gets paid for mm-hmm. the work he does. He doesn't get paid based on how clean the office is going to be in 6 months. So it's very easy, and I go back to being cynical. It's very easy to look at the whole thing and be very cynical about it. It's like you got published, but you still have to work 40 hours a week at another job, mm-hmm. and you still have to do this to make ends meet. It's like if it's going to be your career, it should be your career. I don't know. Is that making sense to you guys? Are you getting what I'm saying?
Chris, why don't you go? Because I have a question too.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say this. I do not make my living as a writer. I make a portion of my mm-hmm. living as a writer, and I do pay a portion of my bills with writing money.
And that's pretty typical.
Yeah, and that portion gets larger every day. And here's why I don't think what I was saying previously was an authory bitch fest. I am painfully aware of the fact that right now I get paid exactly as much as a writer as I should. Simply because market forces dictate this is what I'm worth. To me, I actually don't disagree with much of what you said. My definition of where I would like to be is not to have a vast, you know, Scrooge McDuck style pile of money that I can backstroke through at my leisure. It's actually to make my living full time
right.
as a writer. And what I'm saying, by the way, I think the idea of just suffering for your art and making something as inaccessible as you feel like, even if it only entertains you, at least in a commercial medium like writing genre fiction, is not. It can on occasion be done out of fear of really trying to take a stab at becoming successful at what you do. What I'm trying to do right now is learn how to make that transition. Try to find a space in which I can write the sorts of stories I want to write and make a living doing it. And that's mm-hmm. that's a really interesting space to be in, because it is uncharted territory for me. And as you say, you know, writers, at least until they get into the upper echelons, they're the widgets, they're the disposable parts of the publishing industry. We can be swapped out.
Right. A lot of times there are different types of people, and there are and this is across the spectrum. This is one of the reasons why we have the three rules of podcasting. You know, no religion, no politics, no barbecue. It's because those particular topics, people tend to throw out logic and speak from passion. And when you start speaking from passion, you're not willing to hear other people. Mm-hmm. And so I've talked to authors, and it's kind of funny. I've had authors who are very, very passionate about the art side of it, and they've told me a good book will get published no matter what. And I've talked to editors who tell me that's not really true. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone sends me a good book and it's a good book, but it doesn't fit in with what I'm trying to do and what we're trying to do as an imprint, we're not going to publish that book. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you've got Pyre has what they're trying to do. You have Angry Robot doing what they're trying to do. You've got Tor doing what they're trying to do. Ace, Rock, all these different imprints. Bane, they have a style. They have a it's not necessarily a genre, but they have a style. You know what you're going to get when you pick up a Bane book. You know what you're going to get when you pick up a Tor. There is something there. So just saying, oh, a good book is going to get published, you might find a small indie publisher to publish the book. Absolutely. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Tor is going to publish it, or mm-hmm. Pyre is going to publish it, or Angry Robot's going to publish it. You know, they might sit there and say, it's a good book. Yeah, you're right. It's a good book. Doesn't fit in with what we're trying to do. So I feel like there's a disconnect. You have people like Christine Catherine Rush, who is very pragmatic and looks at publishing from a business point of view, and it's a business. This is what pays her bills. This is how she lives her life, and she's very upfront about that. If you go to her blog, I love her blog because she talks about the business side of publishing. And I think a lot of aspiring authors go into the idea of publishing with rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. And the industry and the business side of publishing is very different from every other business model out there. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to change anytime soon.
See, that's what I find interesting. I agree with that. And I think that, you know, I think I've reached a similar inflection point to the one that John recently did that he wrote about on his blog. But my trajectory is necessarily a little different. We occupy different niches, and you know, I'm at the point where I need to try and make that transition to becoming a full-time writer. And I find you know, authors that refuse to that find the idea that writing is a business distasteful. I don't understand that. It is a business. If I went to my day job and said, look, I really like doing science, guys, but I don't really like the business aspect of this stuff. I'm not going to go to meetings anymore. I'm not going to mm-hmm. deal with the corporate bullshit. I'm just going to go to the lab bench and do my job and, you know, really make myself feel good that I've accomplished something. I would not have that day job for much longer.
Right.
And it's interesting. I mean, you know, and similarly, John, you're not saying you're going to walk away from recording music or even trying to sell your music. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting to realize, you know, okay, now my pie-eyed idealism of like, hey, wow, look, I have a book out and it's so pretty and there are words and stuff. I actually now have to figure out how to turn that into a living. And mm-hmm. that to me is a fascinating challenge and one that, you know, I look forward to and am terrified of in equal measure.
Sure. Go ahead, John.
My example, my model was Jonathan Colton, who was actually obviously very successful with all of this. And I think he inspired a lot of people like me to go out and try again, because I was already in my 30s when I started doing what I'm doing now. But what I've learned over the past few years is that, and I understand everything that Patrick is saying in terms of the business side of things, other than Jonathan Colton, at least within the niche that I consider myself a part of or have considered myself a part of, he is really the only one that I know for sure makes a full-time living doing this. Mm-hmm. That's
probably not rich.
I don't think he's uber rich. I think he can support his family.
Yeah, he does well.
And I don't know the ins and outs of everybody else, but a lot of the people that I've opened for, I know some of them have day jobs. I know some of them are in different points of their life where they're younger than me and they don't have families, and so they have a little more flexibility in their life. So, and I don't quite honestly, I don't know if I ever had the, I'm going to be able to do this full time as a goal, because I don't know if I ever thought that necessarily. The problem that I had is, as I got sort of higher up on that ladder with the rest of these folks, I just started seeing it and then just really not seeing any way to do it. And it's not even so much that I didn't think my stuff was good enough or anything. I just thought, like, I don't think there's really anywhere else to go with this other than where Colton went. And so maybe I need to think about what I'm doing here a little more. And it really just came down to, for me, it's not an artsy fartsy decision. It's really a life decision. Cause Patrick, I totally understand what you're saying about, like, the business versus the doing it for the art and all that. I mean, although I do consider myself pretty artsy fartsy, that's not really the point that I came to. It was like, I'm not having any fun right now. Like, I'm not enjoying this really at all. Like, I'm not enjoying recording the songs. I'm not enjoying this process at all. And I do have a day job and I do have a family, and this is supposed to be for me. And if I'm doing this and I'm not having any fun with it, then I really need to assess what I'm doing. And that's really the point that I came to, is that I was like, I want to have more fun doing this, is really what it comes down to. And whether that's artsy fartsy stuff or anything, I don't know what anything else is, but it's just, I don't think I was going to, I don't think I was getting anywhere on the course that I was on, at least in my own mind. I had a formula that I was kind of using, not in writing songs necessarily, but in, like, I'd write a new song, I'd spend a lot of time recording it, I put it out, that would get me a lot of new listeners. And that worked for me for about 2 or 3 years, where every time I put a new song out, I would get 200 or 300 new people that would sign my mailing list. And that worked great for about 2 or 3 years. And it hasn't worked as well the past year. Part of that might be, maybe I found everybody that's going to like what I do. like I may have reached the limit. I think some of it has to do with streaming too, because I know I use Spotify. I stream everything. I don't download anything anymore. So that might have something to do with it. Either way, my formula stopped working. And so I wasn't seeing any growth there anymore either. So yeah, I just had to assess what I was doing, and I'm happy with where I got, and I want to continue, but I don't want to worry anymore. I don't want to be jealous of other people. I don't want to, you know, if I was able to make a full-time living doing this, like, that would be great. But I don't even think it's about making a full-time living. It's this sort of the successful thing. Like, I should be more respected, more well-known. I should be, you know, all this stuff. And
sometimes, like, that comes from other people.
Well, of course.
Other people telling you. Yeah, saying, well, why weren't you on stage with George R. R. Martin and Neil Gaiman?
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, too. And the thing is that what you have to realize with anything, you don't have any control over that. You really don't, you know. So it's probably better, at least for me, and this is a personal decision I can't do, is like, I'm just not going to worry about that anymore. I'm going to do my best. And does it still come up even since I've made that announcement? Of course. It's not like I like sat under the Bodhi tree and meditated for a while and now I don't worry about any of this anymore. Of course I do. The Double Clicks, who are a group that I opened up for about a year ago too, they just put out a new song that has this great video. It's the Geek Girl one, and they have, like, Scalzi and Will Wheaton in it. And it's a great video, and it's a great song, and it's racking up, like, thousands upon thousands of YouTube hits. And, yeah, there was a moment that came out, and I was like, you know, like, I'm supposed to be doing – and then I step back, and I'm like, it's a great song. They're great. Their success is not my failure. Like, but I think we all do that. Maybe I shouldn't talk for everybody. I think a lot of us do that, where we – you know, we see someone else being successful and we think, like, we should be that successful and we should be doing that. And it's like, no, just concentrate on your own thing.
There are extrinsic forces that do that to you. I mean, I've been very fortunate. The new book has been getting really nice reviews, but the tenor of a lot of those reviews are often, depending on who you ask, I'm either overexposed or nobody's ever heard of me. But a lot of the good reviews say, why aren't more people reading him? Why why is this book popular but this book isn't? And while I appreciate the sentiment behind that, that's not always the most useful.
Constructive.
Exactly. It's amazing because if you know you read one of these reviews, from my perspective, I read one of these reviews, I feel great. I read 10 of them, I feel like shit. I'm like, damn, why aren't I bigger? And then immediately you have that thought of, God, because I'm an asshole. I just thought that. Like, I really just thought, why aren't I bigger? It's an interesting struggle. And that's why I was interested in talking about it, is not to air dirty laundry or not to bitch, but just to talk about, like, there are anxieties that are inherent in every step of the process. When you're at the absolute top, you're probably worrying if you can ever top your landmark work. When you're at the bottom, you wonder if you'll ever write a landmark work. And in the middle, there are these anxieties. And what's interesting is you do hear from people who are you know, maybe earlier on in their careers, you know, you're lucky to be where you are. You should shut up about this because, you know, you have no idea how good you have it. And what's interesting is that's not necessarily true. I have every idea how good I have it. My life, I lead a charmed existence. I just occasionally need to remind myself of that fact.
It's all on where you're at, because that's the experience that I've had recently too, is that you do see within the sort of the continuum of all the people in this community, you have like your Neil Gaimans and George R. R. Martins at the top, and then you have the people that are just getting started, and then you have all the rest of us in the middle somewhere, and everybody is always sort of looking up, you know, and it's somebody that you think of, and I always use Twitter as an example because it's sort of like that metric of how many followers somebody has, and you know, you see somebody with 20,000 followers, and you're like, oh my God, they're so big, and why can't I have that? And then you realize, like, they're jealous of the people that have 100,000 followers, and the people that have 100,000 followers, I know it's not that simple, but that's a metric that I do see it. I do see sort of, for lack of a more delicate way of putting it, you know, I see the people with 20,000 followers kissing the butt of people with 100,000 followers, and I see the people with 100,000 followers kissing the butt of people with 1 million followers, and it's weird the way it works. But ultimately, I don't know how important any of it is, and if we should really even be worried that much about it. But I think, you know, Patrick, I don't know. I know we've been talking for a long time, so I don't know. I've let it go.
And for the listeners, yeah. I mean, I'm the one who controls really how long this podcast goes, because I'm the one who reminds John that we have to wrap it up. And in this case, I have let it go because I thought this was a good conversation, and this was something that, you know, I want people to hear. Now, I want to throw out one more thing, and that is that, you know, the reason that I hesitated to go down this road and talk about this stuff is because you also get the people who come to you and say, well, if you talk about that, the business side, or being cynical or not liking the way the publishing industry works, that can come back on you. And maybe you don't get the book deal. And maybe, you know, it's that whole thing. And so that's why I hesitate a little bit. And John knows that off the air, my smartassery is exponentially greater than it is when I'm on air. And I always go back to the story of my cousin setting up a job interview for me and him kind of coaching me on how to interact with his boss. And I said, well, I'll just be myself. And he said, oh, God, no. You can't do that. You have to ease people into that, Patrick. And so, you know, my instinct is to call bullshit when I see bullshit. And I am, you know, DiNardo was horrified. Jamie Todd Rubin and John DiNardo and I sat down for breakfast one morning in Chi-Con, and he was horrified at my what's the good way to say this? My inability to accept poor customer service from the wait staff. Because I did that job and I know what goes into it. And I know that, you know, in order to be a waiter or a waitress, you're going to make the bulk of your money through tips. And the way you do that is you kiss the ass of whoever's sitting in the seat before you. And my very frank conversation with the server had poor John DiNardo squirming in his seat. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of frank discussion that I think people don't like, especially about the business side of publishing. I strongly encourage people to pay attention to Chuck Wendig's blog, because he does talk about this stuff, but he does it in a entertaining way that kind of slips under the radar. Mm-hmm. Christine Catherine Rush does not. She does not make any bones about it. She talks very succinctly about the business side of publishing, and I think every author, whether they're aspiring or published, needs to pay attention. You know, one of the very first things I ever read on her blog that I have remembered to this day is that when you do get that first publishing contract from someone, the first thing you're supposed to do with it is pick it up and take it to an IP lawyer and make sure that that IP lawyer, that copyright lawyer, looks at that before you ever sign it. You know, it's like, to put it in music vernacular, John, when the guy comes to you in the bar after you've played your set and says, "Hey, you're really great, we want to sign you, here's the contract, but it's only good as long as it's on this table," don't sign that contract.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, get someone who knows what they're doing to look at it first. It's a thing with me. You know, I and I've also been told that I have a sense of justice that is perhaps too black and white and in my approach to justice and right and wrong. And if I see wrong, I call it. And so it's that frankness that people don't always particularly care for. So that's why I hesitated a little bit.
Oh, that's okay.
And now I've rambled for 10 minutes about that.
That's okay. Well, anyway, we could go on and on and on and on, but maybe we should wrap it up there. But thank you for listening, everybody. I think these are useful discussions to have, because I know just from writing that email and writing that blog post, I got a lot of feedback and a lot of people wrestling with the same stuff. So thank you for everybody that emailed me and commented on the blog and Facebook and all that stuff. And it's been good to have this discussion, and it's made me feel good about where I'm at with things, and hopefully we'll all feel good about where we're at with things and move on. So Chris, so your new book is out. It's available right now, and people can find you at chrisfholm.com and at chrisfholm. Anything else you want to let people know before we sign off for the week?
No, that's about it. You can check my website for appearances. I'll post them as soon as I have them. I've got a few coming up in the next few months. So stop on by if you want to meet me or yell at me about anything I said today.
Yeah. Hey, you're on that Functional Nerds podcast. I didn't like what you had to say. Thank you, Chris, for joining us again. You can check out my stuff over at johnanilio.com and follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Patrick has atfmb.com, and he is at atfmb on Twitter. And Patrick, any final thoughts? Things you want to tell people?
Check out Kirkus, because I always have something going on there every couple weeks. SF Signal podcast. I will be at Worldcon. So if like Chris said, if you want to come up to me in person and tell me that I suck and that I'm stupid and that art is art, you know, by all means, there's your chance.
All right. Very good. All right, everyone. Well, thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time.
of my love. It fits you like a glove. Joy, my dream, tell me yes. Bail out, should there be a mess. The pieces you don't need are mine. Take my time. I'll show you cloud nine. Take my smile and my heart, they were yours from the start. The pieces to admit are mine. Have my love. Use it while it does you good. Share my highs, but the just times that you hurt just pain away mine. From the pieces you don't need. And the sun melts the chill from our lives, helping us all to remember what we came here for. This is love. This is love, la, 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 la. This is love. This is la, 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 la. Little things that will change. But I can rock as good as Gibraltar. snake climbing ladder. Got out of the line of fire.
Came through here again, Maxine. messing up and I've been shut down. You're the best thing that I've ever found. Handle me with care. Reputation's changeable. Situation's terrible. But baby, you're adorable. Handle me with care. I'm so tired of being lonely. I still have some love to give. Won't you show me that you really care?
Everybody's got somebody to lean on. Put your body next to mine and dream on.
I've been propped up and I've been fooled. I've been lonely. Well, it's all
phone to ring, waiting for someone to tell you everything. Sit around and wonder what tomorrow will bring. Maybe a diamond ring.
Well, it's all right, even if they say you're wrong. Well, it's all right. Sometimes you gotta be strong. Well, it's all right.
Somewhere down the road away,
the end of the line.
You'll think of me and wonder where I am these days.
The end of the line, of the line.
Maybe somewhere down the road when somebody plays
the end of the line.
The purple haze.
Well, it's all right, even when push comes to shove. Well, it's all right.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.